Hey, cats and kittens, this is Wesley hosting Nerds on the Rocks, episode number 97, because, hey, I haven't hosted an episode since the Comic Gamble I once hosted, so, hey, let's get the second go. So,
cats and kittens, I have not heard that.
So, on my adventures episode, I'm going to be doing a focus on the, well, you know, I'm down with the kids. I'm hip.
You down with the squirrel?
Yeah, you know, I'm hip.
You're down with OPP?
Yeah.
You know me.
Thank you.
Woo, there it is.
I am as hip as Ned Flanders in the left-handed accessory store. So, you know. But, okay, anyway, after that random off-track moment, this is episodes focused around Grant Morrison's X-Men. If we try to do everything Grant Morrison in one episode, we'd be here a while. A very long while. Focusing on the X-Men will basically keep it sane for everyone involved. So, well, it's sane as a Grant Morrison work can be. So, all right, so the Avengers for Force Space on this episode are Ashley.
Magneto was right.
Nicholas.
Woo! Grant Morrison! Yay!
Mr. Earl.
I'll be busy doing stuff for Emma Frost in my head, so don't mind me.
Don't worry. Have your psychic affair with Emma Frost, go for it. But, okay, so back in around March 2001 began this run. Now, the crazy thing about Grant Morrison's X-Men run was, at the time period it came about, the X-Men were in a messy state, to say the least. It was coming off of the really weird Chris Claremont run, which didn't exactly go over very well with fans. About as well as anything could go at that period, because... Have you ever read that Chris Claremont X-Men run? I mean, did you guys read that?
One.
The one just before Grant Morrison's run began.
No, I did not.
Yeah, I own that run. It's very weird, but it had the whole Neo and very quirky, and it didn't really go over very well with people. Though it has some nice art, but it was very all over the place. But... that period was very odd. So Grant Morrison pretty much got free reign to go fairly nuts with X-Men right around that period. And he really got to cut loose and take X-Men. Because I read his manifesto, and pretty much his goal was to take X-Men and make it a pop culture. Like, pretty much a pop, like, very much a big part of pop culture again, make it pop. I mean, he wanted to be like, every issue, you cannot miss it. You will want to read every single bit of X-Men. And also, he worked to take the X-Men out of 1963 and put it into the 21st freaking century, which is what it direly needed. And that's what I like, and that's what was very interesting about that early thousands period of comics right then, because if you guys... pretty much know that the early thousands was probably one of the more very fascinating periods of comics. Don't you agree? Because they were trying some very trippy stuff around that time point.
Well, it was just as they were really trying to recover from the mistakes of the 90s, which let's wrap everything in foil and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And good thing they learned from that and they don't use gimmicks anymore.
Yeah, and you know what else is great? That Rob Liefeld is finally, like, working at a Walmart or something.
During the early thousands, people were trying out new stuff. I mean, you had different projects coming out. You had stuff that you would never have seen published any other period, but around the early thousands, they were actually trying out stuff. And Grant Morrison's X-Men hit right around that right period where people were just dying to see something different, and Grant Morrison's X-Men, by golly, gave them that something different. And it was interesting when I talked about this initially, because I had many commentaries popping up on my Twitter about this one. Mostly people were like hoping, like a little bit of like basically going from, oh, wow, that was so cool, to, and I had one very, very some commentary that people were not really a big fan of Grant Morrison's run. So that run was very polarizing for people, to say the least.
I feel like that's Grant Morrison in a nutshell.
Oh, yeah,
though, gotcha.
And he works that, and he lives that up. You can fucking tell, he loves to be polarizing.
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, fuck the Virgil, that's what I say.
Fuck the Virgil.
Oh, I mean, fuck the people who don't like it. There, that's what I'm looking for. There,
And it's interesting because the first, because in two, when it hit the first arc of Grant Morrison's run was, I don't care who you are, that was a dang fine first arc. That was probably one of the most strongest first arcs of a freaking start of a comic I'd ever witnessed, because it was so damn good.
Let's kick things off with Genocide. I mean,
yep. Exactly. How can you, like, wait. Well, where can we go? 16 million mutants down the drain within one story arc. That'll work.
Yeah,
it
wasn't the very
first page. Wasn't it Wolverine taking down a Sentinel and it says you can stop doing that now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, there, that's the mission statement right there. That's, in true Grant Morrison fashion, that's pretty much a microcosm of the entire run.
Yeah. It's pretty much he made a point to, in this run, he made the X-Men, mainly the X, I mean, he purged out most of the old villains, outside of Magneto, which we'll get into, but pretty much Magneto and also he used very minimal amounts of, he used like very small amounts of the X-Men stuff, but he also kept most of the major other villains out of there. And he mainly created new concepts for the X-Men to play around in, because he was like, you know what? Fresh start. Let's see what happens. Because people don't realize, like, because I was reading this, the one thing I noticed is, some people will disagree, but I do say this, he made Scott Summers pretty badass for the most part. I mean, he broke Scott Summers to make him stronger in the end. Because he broke him to make him stronger, because he was already fairly broken before that. I mean, he had the whole Apocalypse thing and the end Saba Nur thing and then all that crap, and then he just went, yep, let's see what we can do to make Scott stronger by breaking him entirely in two. And it was pretty interesting. It was a very interesting look in how you deconstruct and then reconstruct the character by the time you're done. It's like you leave him stronger by the time he's finished with him.
That's something that Whedon kind of picked up when continued on. It's something that both Morrison and Whedon did, where they took Scott, who had always been, like, the Boy Scout, good guy, upstanding, da-da-da-da-da, and what happens when just shit is dumped on him that he can't handle and he cracks? And that's what you wanted to see with Scott Summers. You didn't want him to be able to, like, I was possessed by Apocalypse and my wife doesn't love me, but it's okay. I have a stick up my ass. Ha ha, Scott Summers.
Yeah.
You wanted to see him be like, fuck you, I'm going to have a psychic affair with the half-naked supervillain.
Yeah.
Which, and like, I cannot say enough good about Morrison bringing Emma Frost in the way he did and making her such a major player in the universe. And maintaining the fact that she was Emma fucking Frost. Like, she is not necessarily a good guy.
No, not at all.
But yeah, and I mean, he exploited his characters. He put them through hell. He made me like Scott Summers, which is impossible to do. And he made me interested in the Phoenix Force, which also, the Phoenix Force in Jean Grey, also extremely difficult to do.
And I agree with that, because I was, especially when I got to that point, and because it's weird, for some odd reason, like, for at that point, I was like, when they did the Phoenix Force storyline, he really nailed the Phoenix Force and really made that very compelling. It was one of the more compelling pieces that's about how he handled Jean, because his handling of Jean was pretty damn good. it's reasons why Jean, by the time Jean Grey was gone out of this, no one's really been willing to bring her back, because Morrison gave a really nice send-off to Jean Grey. I mean, and it was very interesting to see how they worked that. I mean, and even what was funny, and one of the more major things was also the handling of the Beast in this. Beast, oh God, that was a ride. I remember the aforementioned Kitty Beast transformation. And
that was for this, and, right?
Oh,
that was for Morrison. Morrison was the one who did that.
Yeah, Morrison did the Kitty Beast. He did Kitty Beast, and it... And I remember in my comic store, the conversations that happened with Kitty Beast. And, oh God, Oh, my Lord. As the Beast, oh, my stars and fucking garters. Because it got interesting in there. Kitty Beast is still that sort of touchy subject of people that there's, because it was interesting to see that before New X-Men, they actually had an Extreme X-Men where he was still normal Beast, and Chris Claremont's run of that, when he was working on Extreme X-Men in the initial first arc, and then they had to explain, this takes place before the New X-Men Grant Morrison started. It's like, this happened before the Kitty Beast transformation. Because it was, and he really played with the Beast. I mean, every character got a little bit of play out of Grant. He streamlined the cast. That was the one thing I want to mention, the streamlining of the whole damn thing. The streamlining of the cast was very smart, because he had the cast pretty much streamlined to, like, basically six things, like Professor X and Professor X, Beast, Jean Grey, Wolverine, Emma Frost, and Cyclops, and then adding in Zorn, and then, then of course the really random appearances of also the down the road of Beacon Angel in the students with, I have issues with Beacon Angel, but we'll get into that in a minute, but it was very weird, but very interesting how after that first arc, how he basically had Professor X say, "Hi, I'm a mutant," through the freaking villain, I might add, that the villain was the one that brought the X-Men out of 1963 and basically said, "Hi, we're mutants. We're here," and opened the school up to everything. And it was very daring and pretty much like, and no retconning, no, this happened. Mr. X opened, no reversal, no, this happened. And what really gets weird about it is, because also I think it's also helped by the fact that you have Frank Quitely doing that first story arc, and holy crap, Quitely was on. He was still not at his heights then, but he was still pretty damn. He was coming off freaking Earth 2, and so he was hitting his game pretty hardcore on that book. Then of course, someone realized, hey, you know what happens to Frank Quitely? We don't give him enough lead time, do we? No. He can't handle a monthly title, can he? No. Crap. Ethan Van Seaver! Yeah, we need to be Ethan Van Seaver! Okay. And Ethan, he did a dang fine job, but then came Igor Cordy. Poor Igor Cordy. I mean, seriously.
He got a bum gig, is what happened.
He really did.
Yeah.
He got a bum deal. 2 weeks. He had, I think he did have, 2 weeks to a month. Like, I think, 2 weeks to kind of crap an issue out. And he had some decent panels here and there in his issues that he blasted out within those short weeks of time frame, but by golly, why does the Dark Star look so hard? Like, no, he had to rush those out quick to keep up, because it was delayed, and they had to rush it out really fast. Because I've seen Igor Cordy's artwork outside of this New X-Men, and he's really damn good. I mean, he actually is a damn good artist, but when you're an artist, I don't care how good you are. If you have to crap something out within 2 weeks and crap out of like a 32-page comic, yeah, your work's gonna suffer. Your work's gonna suffer hard when you have to go, you're piping out 2 pages every, faster than lightning. I mean, yeah, it's not gonna be as strong.
Either that or make a lot of fast pages.
Yeah.
It's like,
how many fight scenes are in this book? Can we just spread them out over, 2-page spreads the whole way through?
Yeah.
Well, they get no, that's another tour for that, for X-Men versus Avengers versus X-Men.
Well, you get it. It's very, and because I would say, because they're kind of weird, because the villains, and that's when things get really weird, is the Shi'ar arc. And it's like, you go, first arc, holy crap. Second arc, the Shi'ar arc after the Aether Extinction. This is the reason why I have all my X-Men collections right nearby me, by the way. So, because And it's because it's very, because I actually made a point to keep these all nearby me just in case I got mixed up in my arc orders. But no, it's a, yeah, it's a even Van Siever stuff and then get into the Shi'ar arc because that's a, is a, no, it's a Yumen and Shi'ar arc.
Okay. Oh, Yumen.
Yumen first. The Yumen was a, yeah, that was the beginning of, yeah, that was the beginning of the, because.
And see, one of the things that I love about Morrison in general is his approach to writing is very big picture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everything that happens in his whole run is, like, he did that final, the final arc he did, where it's in the future, and you find out that everything in his run tied together, everything, nothing was accidental.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was, you know, that is such a fucking Morrison thing. It's
every
little thing. It's, you're gonna see the big picture, but you're not gonna realize you're seeing it while it's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the, that's, I love his approach to writing is that he is so about, like, it is an art form. I mean, there are still, there are writers and artists who treat comics like a genre.
Correct.
It's just, you know, and then you get people like Morrison who are like, no, this is its own unique art form and you have to work with it and you have to realize the possibilities rather than just throwing together, you know, 2 months of adventure and then maybe it'll build up to a massive crossover. No, everything has to be important.
And this is what made, and also the nice thing about Morrison's new X-Men run was the fact that there were no major freaking events he had to get involved in. It was one uninterrupted Grant Morrison adventure. And this is where things get very contentious because when the Magneto run kicks in the gear after the revelation of Zorn not being who he is, and that...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, sorry, kids, but...
That was a huge moment, by the way. I love that. Like, that was one of those things where I read it, and I was like, I didn't see this coming at all.
No, I saw that. I don't care who you are. You did not see that coming because they did not relate Zorn as... Because, by the way, kids, the spoiler's over 8 years old now, so...
yeah, it doesn't count.
It's we're okay. We are in the zone here of it's okay.
Besides, it's a spoiler. They retconned those motherfuckers.
Yes, they did retcon that hard because I actually
fuck
went.
Them.
Yeah, it
fuck
they retconned that so hard because there is because the Zorn. What was weird about that whole thing is the way they handled the Zorn thing is like down like Zorn basically was initially brought in as a giant like he had a living, he was a living star inside him, and the Iron Prison, and within that very odd Marvel scope idea they were trying out at the time, which is really weird to read in an Ultimate collection, by the way, I must add. It is really weird.
Oh, with everything turned to the side?
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
But Lanil did a really pretty damn good job with that, honestly, because it actually did do some cool visuals here, like pretty damn cool visuals. Because it just really worked, and but the way Zorn was brought in, you go, oh, Zorn, this guy's actually kind of cool, isn't he? Like, yeah, he is kind of cool, and you really get to like this guy. And you're like, oh, yeah, he's really nice. He can heal people. Da da da. Oh, what the hell is happening here? Because so it's just crazy. I mean, from Zorn to the freaking Stepford Cuckoos that were Emma Frost's freaking helpers that. Telepathic proteges, and they were, God, I mean, and by the way, Stepford Cuckoo's still lasting in the Marvel Universe to this day. That
yeah, though I'm still not sure how I feel about the retcon on that. I don't know if it was retcon or if this is something Morrison had always intended, but the fact that they're technically Emma's biological daughters.
They don't really get into that. I mean, good.
Not in Morrison's run, but in Phoenix Warsong, I think.
Okay.
They reveal that at one point, when Emma was in her coma, they harvested her genetic material and made, like, a million Stepford Cuckoo clones, and were going to, Weapon X was going to use them to wipe out all the other mutants.
Holy
comics, everybody.
Good night. Damn. You see, oh, Lord. It's just so weird, because it's very hard, like, you have, it's really weird when you get into, like, Grant Morrison, they were talking about Grant Morrison treated comics as an art. He treats it as an art form, and genuinely because doesn't understand that the DC universe is a living, breathing thing. I mean, he actually and he treated the X-Men as a truly evolutionary book because I will state this again. He took the X-Men out of 1963 when Marvel did not want them out of 1963 by the end of his run. They basically, because pretty much Marvel got a little scared by the fact that Morrison took them out of the 60s and into the 21st century. Because
right back in that box.
Yeah, we are right back in that box hard right now.
Our merchandisers
now we're
can't
back to the
sell.
90s.
Our merchandisers can't sell your characters despite the fact that they're modeled after the movie that's more widely known than our comics, and despite the fact that they look really freaking cool.
Mm-hmm.
Our merchandisers can't sell anything that's not in the traditional costumes, so Morrison, you have to put them back in the costumes. That didn't go over well with Graham.
Yeah. There's good reason why...
Focus Graham, of me, is how he said it.
Yeah. He's like, what the fuck are you talking about here? I'm not bringing back
your costumes. That's almost German, man.
Sorry, yeah. I just got it. I can't do Grant's voice.
Neither can I. I can only... That's about it. It's fucking great, Mike. There you go.
Aim for Shrek and swear a lot. And you've got Grant Morrison.
Sorry, see, that doesn't work, man.
And I always just end, up sounding like John Cleese in the Scott of the Antarctic sketch from Monty Python. It's great! Cut it! It's great! Print! Great!
Oh, God. Yeah, I know that sketch, too. Oh, God. It's baffling to me, especially the costumes. The unified costumes, guess what, kids? They work. They really do work. Sorry to burst anyone's bubble here. The unified costumes work. I mean, they fit the evolution of the X-Men because they have a unified outfit. They look like an actual organization rather than any general superhero team. No, they look like a general organization rather than and it was interesting to say Grant explains everything. He doesn't just go, he actually explains why everything's happening. Like, oh, the costumes? Yeah, we're an organization. We're not just a superhero team. No, we're an organization. We look like a search and rescue or a general organization. And the other factor is when it gets really trippy is you deal with the fact that you have some really, it gets really trippy especially in the Magneto, when you get into the big Magneto battle at the end of the, near the end of the book, and one commentary is, well, weren't the other superheroes involved in the big battle? And it's like, and Magneto goes, well, and they first, oh, he put a shield on, outside of the city, so pretty much this is the X-Men situation now. And I remember there was one thing people did not like, that the other heroes weren't involved in the book. And I'm going, Grant probably did not, because if that would have been any other situation, that would have become an event in the Marvel Universe if it was happening now. That would have been, holy by God, every damn superhero involved in this whole giant thing, and it would have been a 30-issue gargantua fest of, here, 30 issues of big, giant superheroes knockdown dragon. It's like, hey, Grant finished up in those 6 issues.
Yeah, but, I mean, as much as I would not have wanted it to have become a major event, because there was no reason for it to.
Correct.
The thought of Grant Morrison writing Spider-Man...
Yes.
Kind of fascinates me.
That would have been interesting. I'll retcon part of that statement, because that actually would have been kind of cool to actually say, actually see Spider-Man, or... Though it would have been interesting to see how he would have handled Spider-Man, because he got to handle Fantastic Four in his time there. He got to handle a few different things, but him as Spider-Man would have really been cool.
I'm not sure how he would have done Spider-Man, just because he's like such a polar opposite style of character from what Grant usually does. Yeah. That would have been odd, yeah.
That would have been really cool.
I would have loved to have seen, his take on Spider-Man, Captain, like all of the traditional Avengers. I fucking would have loved to have seen what he would have done with Doctor Strange.
Oh, God, yes. Imagine if someone would have thought, hey, you know what, let's put Grant on the Avengers. That would have actually been really cool, too, because, yes, people would have said JLA, but no, would have been actually really cool to see, too, because this probably would have let, if the X-Men wouldn't have ended the way they did with how Marvel handled him near the end. We could have probably seen Grant Morrison having his take on pretty much nearly every Marvel team at some point or another. Just they could have actually had Grant for a while.
And with stuff like Doctor Strange or the Scarlet Witch or something, I'm just thinking about, you know, what he did with Seven Soldiers.
Oh, God.
In DC.
God. I own
and
those
what he would have done with the magical characters in the Marvel Universe. Like,
oh, Jesus, can you imagine him doing, like, a Steve Ditko-esque Doctor Strange
story?
Oh, my God. That would have been insanely great.
And he would have played it up as Ditko-esque, because, I mean, the man loves his fucking history.
I mean, he ultimately kind of did that with Zatanna anyway, but still, that would have been awesome.
Or, I mean, Doctor Strange, Scarlet Witch, I mean, he could have gone really nuts, but... But after a while, I think Marvel kind of went, we don't want Morrison with our toy chest any further. Because, I mean, and of course, make note, I am one of the people who describes this Avengers X-Men as the big shiny toy box. So I pretty much new X-Men, I actually think, he's playing with our toys in the way we're not totally comfortable with anymore. Okay, not as much Marvel, but the merchandisers were not comfortable with Grant Morrison playing with their toys any further. And then Grant Morrison, like, okay. And then he sets them, and then the final arc is pretty much him going, here. I mean, the final arc is just this crazy final arc. I mean, and what's neat, though, is, like, Phantom X still survives in the Marvel Universe to this day.
Hell yeah, he does. I love it.
Yes.
And freaking Remender still keeps them in Uncanny X-Force in a big way. I mean, and then you have Phantom X mixed in with that hint that he survived was amazing. Because the stuff that survived out of Morrison's run is kind of amazing to think about. The Stepford Cuckoos, the White Queen Cyclops relationship surviving to this day is mind-blowing that it's managed to survive to this day. But it's the thing is people, it worked well, and they were like, and Whedon also kept like, Whedon like, no, I actually like that too. Okay, thanks, Joss. And if people accept liking it, so like, this keeps going. So, I mean, and Phantom X to bits and there's more that kind of got little bits and pieces, but most of it got, with most of Morrison's run got kind of purged under the water in the preceding few years. By now, outside of those few little bits, most of them are kind of gone, because by golly, we cannot have the X-Men leave night. Cannot have the X-Men leave the fact that they're being persecuted, because he turned the X-Men into celebrity. Like, he kind of made them a lot more... He made mutants cool. He made mutants cool. He made them the new hip crowd. The new... Everyone wants to be a mutant. And that was cool. I mean, that was very interesting to see how he was exploring that. He was exploring the idea of mutants are the new cool. Yeah. Let's see how we can go there. And he did it. I mean... And yeah, some people might kind of go like all the weird mutants that he kind of introduced, like instead of faking them all, he actually had much more otter mutations or much more like, but you know what? He kind of said, and even though I kind of have some weird things with Angel or Beak at some points, I mean, I think probably they're probably one of the weaker parts of the run, though eventually they become better. By the final arc, Angel and Beak actually have their redeeming moments in the final arc, but before that, it's kind of really weird how Angel and Beak are handled. I mean, I'm not sure what you guys think about the Angel and Beak additions to it, but it's...
I'm never quite sure how to deal with Angel, because sometimes she reads to me too much of Morrison trying to write a young, stereotypical black girl.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, she's trashy, and... She dresses kind of skanky, and she uses bad language, and I'm always like, really, Grant?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is leaning way too far into stereotype for my comfort levels. You know, applause for trying to introduce a character who wasn't the typical, you know, you're introducing characters who aren't white men, which
Correct.
Is great. But you did it in a way that's kind of,
and Angel... And of course, Beak is a tougher one for me, because I find myself at times, like, there's part of his character that I dislike, because I dislike someone I kind of like part, because she has a really cool, very nice arc about him by the time he's done with that. Because, especially by the time the Magneto arc kicks in, he's he's had himself a hell of a story arc. And though he's very hit or miss with me, it's still, I don't know, it's very weird with Beak. Angel is much more, a little more concrete, but the Beak one is much more, like, dislike, and yet I kind of like parts of it, so it's very weird in how that was all handled for me. But it definitely did fit into Tim really trying to expand out the mutant population in a way that no one had really, that really hadn't been played with in a while. Because people, what's interesting is for all the stuff I kind of get into, like Tim following up on a Claremont run, a lackluster Claremont run, his X-Men stuff is really a big shiny, like, homage to Claremont in the early Claremont runs of, because the X-Men's Manifesto, the late 70s, like from 77 to 80, is that Claremont run of all those storylines of what he was doing. He actually said, like, those were the best. Like, he said, those were some of the best stuff. And he actually says in his manifesto, I mean, it's really neat to see him going, no, guys, that was the greatest stuff, and I want to play with that. I mean, it's like the final story arc, Days of Future Past. I mean, go bam, bam, bam. I mean, but it's very much, and people would not really catch on. It's like, yeah, it's basically him doing a Claremont. But yet, at the same time, he's still doing his own thing. And he you can tell he has such a deep respect for Chris Claremont a deep respect for Chris Claremont within the run while still being Grant Morrison, cutting loose on this, but it was interesting to see how Grant's visions went throughout the X-Men line during this period, because that's when we had District X come about, that's when we had the very kind of quirky Uncanny X-Men run with Joe Casey, kind of hit or miss, but kind of interesting to see. For goodness sake, this is a period where we had Ashley Wood on an X-Men book. Make note on this. Ashley Wood drew an X title at one point. Eddie Campbell did part of an X book during this period. Just think about this a minute here. I mean, people that you would have never really thought anything like an X were doing X books during this period. I mean, it was very interesting to see some of this exploration they were playing around with here. Did you guys ever read any of, like, the stuff that kind of spun out of Grant Morrison's run, like the Uncanny X run Joe Casey did or stuff like that? Because that's what kind of struck me fascinating, too.
No, I continued on with Astonishing when Whedon took over, and I read the second run of New X-Men, which we had talked about, I think, last week, with the Who Are They Gonna Kill Off This Week?
Yeah.
Which, you know, I appreciated that the same way that I appreciated Morrison keeping a lot of things grounded at the school.
Mm-hmm.
But for a very long time, I did not really read Marvel. I read a lot of DC and not a whole lot of Marvel. And actually, it's funny because I didn't read Morrison's run when it was first coming out.
Okay.
But I remember I found my brother had picked up a copy of the issue where Cassandra Nova controls Beak and makes him beat Beast with the baseball bat. And I read that, and I remember thinking, like, this is the most fucked up shit. Like, this poor kid standing there, hitting his mentor with a bat and frantically apologizing while Xavier's standing there fucking laughing at them.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking at the time, it's like, this is really cool. But it didn't occur to me to, like, you know, well, maybe I should start reading comics again. And then years later, when I was rereading the arc, and I'm like, oh, shit, that was Morrison who did that. And just remembered, like, how much that piqued my interest as someone who wasn't, at the time, buying or reading a lot of comics. And so it's one of those things that Marvel really fucked up with.
Yeah, after I got done with my giant read of this, because I spent like an entire, I did similar to what I did with the Invisibles. I have spent one giant week of just reading all my Ultimate collection. I just started reading them. and I actually thought, oh God, I mean, and I almost kind of, in a weird way, it kind of made me a little crankier about Avengers versus X-Men and the general way right now the X-Men are handled in a very quirky fashion. I mean, it's weird how Morrison was trying. He wanted, it was his way. The way he was doing X-Men was he was establishing to get more people to check out X-Men that haven't, like, he was to people who say had watched the X-Men movie. Well, hey, you guys can read this. This is, it's like, that's why he went with the more, the costume similars in the movie, the X's mm-hmm. with the leather jackets, simplified everything. I mean, he made it so, I mean, and people probably think, well, wait, but he's introducing all these weird concepts. So what did that do, the opposite effect to readers? Like, no, actually, it would probably make some people very fascinated to see, huh, what is this odd thing?
Well, because it wasn't just superheroes fighting supervillains. I mean, it was literature.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and that was, and I mean, and there have been other writers that have really tried to keep up with that. Yeah. And, you know, they have tried to make it. The problem is it hits a point, and I know that there are people that I have talked to, friends who don't read comics, especially, and people who don't read superhero comics, because the superhero idea, as it's traditionally handled, just kind of bores them. And they've said as much. They're like, eh, I don't really care about guys in spandex fighting other guys in spandex. And so for someone to be able to take the capes and make them interesting for non-cape readers is awesome. And Morrison is one of the prime examples of that. And this X-Men run was, you know, it's they're a paramilitary group. They wear Kevlar. They dress for combat.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when he walked away and Joss Whedon was handed it and told, okay, put them back in costume, he managed to do it in a way that made sense. And Morrison, yeah, even in Super Gods, like, praises him for it. He's like, he managed to do it in a way that worked and was true to what I had been writing. Yeah, but
shit all over it.
No, like, no. Yeah,
pretty much every other thing that tried to follow up Grant Morrison stuff.
Yeah, yeah, because Whedon, like, respected Morrison's run, worked with it, used Cassandra Nova again during his run on Astonishing. In that fucked up story where it's like, oh yeah, all of this is just happening in Emma's head.
Oh yeah, I remember that storyline too, and that was insane. I mean,
yeah.
Like, and it's like Whedon's the continuation of Morrison's run, but it was weird. Every other writer was kind of like, what? What do we do with Morrison's run? What? We don't know what.
Let's just retcon everything.
Oh yeah, because
Magneto was never Zorn. That was Zorn's twin brother who was crazy and hopped up on drugs and thought he was Magneto, but he's not really Magneto.
Goofballs, everyone, hopped up on goofballs.
Oh, and the whole Kick thing, yeah, Kick, yeah, Kick.
Oh no, fuck that. Kick was one of my, like, the mutant drug.
Yeah, that was. And it was very interesting how it was here. In that last half of the book, the way they did the Kick stuff was pretty interesting. It was very interesting, actually, how they examined that. And they examined that whole aspect of a drug culture within the mutants. And it was pretty, very fascinating to see how they handled it. I was like, how
it was culture.
Especially once it was established in the final arc that Kick was actually an aerosol version of the Sublime
Thank
personality.
Yeah!
It's even weirder. It's like, whoa! It all ties together because Morrison pretty much tied it all together in one. And pretty much said, yep, his entire arc pretty much ties together in one shiny package. I mean, and pretty much he notes this, I mean, with the new X-Men, he pretty much modernized. And it, people kind of go, well, what about the JLA? I mean, he kept them all in costume. Like, well, it's a JLA.
But that works.
It's a different beast.
Yeah.
It's a different beast. He kept them in costume. And it worked. And he was...
And he kept Superman in that fucking energy costume.
He made it cool.
He made it work, yeah.
He's the only one. I don't care who you are. I will always tell people, guys, I don't care what you say. He's the only person who's ever made that energy costume work. I know because I have read, because I was very, like, during, I was not really reading Superman during that period. So, when I read the Superman and the Red, like, going, reading Red, I'm going, random, oh my, what the hell is this? what the hell is this? And then Morrison, and then the Electric Superman. I will make the moon with two poles.
Yeah.
Holy shit, Grant. Whoa, that's awesome. He made Electric Superman work. Oh my, and it worked.
Oh, there was so much in Grant's run. Like, I mean, but there are certain things you know Grant is pretty much going to do in pretty much anything he does, and that's he likes to play around with a possible apocalyptic future, because he played with it in JLA, where Anti-Life got released, and you saw the future.
Yeah.
You saw
rough
that future.
Ages.
And he did it again in Final Crisis, where you saw the future with the New Fury. He does it in X-Men, and...
He did it in Batman.
And the Invisibles is pretty much entirely like apocalyptic future as possible.
It, by the way, this is why the day we're saving the Invincibles for the Invisibles for an entire freaking podcast in its own right, because that's detailed, guys. I mean, by the way, Earl, this is officially a Morrison cast, so you can just call it Morrison cast now. Especially Morrison cast. So, if there's anything Morrison you want to comment on, it's all fair game now.
You got a couple hours? I mean,
well,
yeah.
I mean, but,
yeah. We could spend.
I still need to eat dinner.
Well, we still have a little bit of time left to kind of get into a few more little aspects of it. I mean,
we could spend the next 6 hours talking about Grant Morrison and Chaos Magic.
Well,
if you really want to.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much look at like from JLA to X-Men to any, like, when Grant Morrison on a superhero book, you know it's not going to be like anything else you probably could. Even, I mean, like, what do you guys think about his Action Comics? I'm curious, actually, what.
I haven't read a lot of it. I've read issues like 2, 3, and 4.
Okay.
And I saw where he was approaching it, and I liked that, you know, because, of course, I had just read Super Gods, and he talks about, you know, his appreciation for the classic Superman, and the fact that Superman was this working-class hero in the very beginning. So the fact that in Action Comics, you've got this very young, unsure of himself Superman, like the second issue, he's being horribly tortured by Lex Luthor, second or third issue, And it's one of those other things, like I was talking about, Morrison made me like certain concepts in X-Men. I don't read Superman. I will read Superman if Morrison writes Superman.
Can I wish
like
you...
All-Star.
All-Star. By the way, I wish Morrison was writing the main Superman book right now, but because I really, really dislike the main Superman book right now, but... I wish more... But, of course, Morrison's on Batman, Inc. again, which makes me very happy, because Morrison doing Batman Incorporated is, it's like pure mad, like, I know, Earl, you read Batman Incorporated, didn't you?
Yeah.
Okay. What did you think of it?
I enjoyed it. I like the concept, even though I don't think it's something that's really out in the Bat books anymore, with the whole, like, Batman as a corporate entity. I think everybody kind of figured out who the main threat was going to be, but it was a nice twist, because it does kind of tie back to his run, because Ra's al Ghul has kind of been a big presence in his Batman run.
Yeah.
So that was nice to see Talia. I mean, not that, and he did give him Damian, so Talia ties back into this whole thing.
The first issue of the New 52 Batman Incorporated is insane. It is the coolest. It is very cool. It's funny because it's very interesting what Chris Burnham does with the whole aspect of what Morrison's doing with his run, because he's really playing with the Batman Incorporated concept. And because it was funny when people realize, like, Batman Incorporated, it's continued from the old DCU, yes, and it's still part of New 52, yes. Just have fun.
The thing is that Batman hasn't really changed much from
exactly.
New 52. I think the thing, and it's kind of interesting, is that it's not often that you have two concurrent types of stories that you have for a character. So I hope what Scott Snyder is doing with the whole Night of Owls and Court of Owls stuff. But it doesn't really fit into the whole I mean, I guess, you know, Batman Inc. doesn't have to fit into it, but it's really a different concept.
Correct.
Because, like, that's focused on the Bat family. It's just Batman, Nightwing, Batgirl, Red Robin, Robin, and Red Hood. And that's the Bat family. It's not, like, Batwing and...
And
is Batwing...
Batwing's technically part of the Bat family because in Batman Incorporated, he actually puts in Batwing in the issue. And I was like, whoa, Batwing! Holy crap! I mean, he put in a few things in there. I'm going, wow, okay. He slipped some of these people in here. And it's very interesting. I mean, Batman Incorporated, it is one of those weird books that doesn't really fit into what Batman's going through right now. Not really, but you know what? It's really cool. So I'll more than have, it's like one of those, yeah, I'm cool with this. I'm not even going to try to ponder where it fits in continuity at this point. I'm just going to enjoy it and see where it goes at this stage in the game, because I like Morrison's Batman. I would really like Morrison's Batman. I mean, especially
Morrison made Batmite awesome.
Yes!
Like, he used Batmite in an awesome, awesome way. I think it was R.I.P.?
Yes, it was R.I.P.
Yeah, and Batmite's like, yes, I'm a fourth dimensional being. Also, I'm part of your imagination.
Yeah. Also, Zur-En-Arr.
Oh, yeah. Zur-En-Arr.
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 You guys.
Well, if he did. Well, that's the important thing with his Batman run is the big, like, genius, holy shit moment was him acknowledging that all of Batman's continuity existed from 1939.
Yeah.
To now.
Mm-hmm.
Was fair game and a thing that happened, whether it was in Batman's, you know, hallucinations because of, you know, stupid, crazy drugs and whatever, or whether it was something that actually happened. It was all viable and could be used in story.
Which means
an amazing stroke of genius.
Which technically means that Batman and Superman did go back in time to Salem, and Superman nearly had Batman burned as a witch.
Yeah.
Oh my god, I want to see Morrison take on that story.
I was going to say, because I think it's from Tiny Titans, but the whole Bat-Cow thing.
Yeah.
Yes!
Bat-Cow, by the way, the entirety of, I swear, when I did my review of it, I actually said, by the way, the debut of Bat-Cow. I love Bat-Cow. I was like, you might be like, oh, and Bat-Cow's awesome. I swear, I think I did put something in there like that. Because it's like, I got a kick out of that so much of seeing freaking Damian going, I am now a vegetarian, and this is Bat-Cow.
And the fact that it was Damian, like, I'll kill anything, but now I won't eat meat.
I won't eat meat. Bat-Cow.
It's like in the future when he had the cat named Alfred.
Did I ever, there's a funny story involving Batman R.I.P. I have to share about one of my friends, and I'm not even saying it to be mean, it just cracked me up. I was just gone through Batman R.I.P. and the trade recently had come out, and my friend got a hold of it. And this is what I got on my Facebook after he got done. I was like, Wes, I just read Batman R.I.P. I'm very lost and confused right now. Am I supposed to be lost and confused right now? What happened? I don't know what's happening here. What is going on? What?
And I think that's usually the biggest complaint I see labeled against Grant Morrison's storylines is either people don't follow it well, or they feel like they, because like everything he does is kind of like building a tower. Like they feel like they're missing the whole picture with the individual blocks,
It's partially that. It's partially them being impatient and being like, I don't understand what's going on. It's just, and not realizing that with Morrison, you kind of have to just go with it.
Yeah.
Why isn't everything automatically making sense to me? Why aren't Why aren't you handing it to me on a platter? Why are you making me think about this? Fuck you, Grant Morrison. I'm going to go to Jeff Johns.
There's a good chunk of his writing that just kind of, he expects the audience to put more thought into it than some are willing. Like, Final Crisis was a big complaint about Final Crisis. People said, oh, they're just, stuff just happens, and they just move from the, it's like, no, he's expecting you to fill in the gaps. Like, you're not going to say, and then they flew here. You're just to expect that, and then they're there, which means they got there somehow. Nothing happened. Are we going to show you the boring plane trip?
You have to reread it.
And what I did for my friend, who was, who was a little confused by RIP, I got him a copy of the Black Case book. And I got him a copy of that. And that explained, like, that kind of goes into the bits and pieces in the Batman RIP. And I said, here, if you kind of want Batman RIP to help you make a little bit more sense, here's the Black Case book. Actually kind of helped, because he kind of went, okay, I can see where this fits in. And this is where it gets really weird with Morrison's run. Some people get into Morrison's Batman. It's the fact that you've got people who get into Morrison's Batman, and they like a certain Batman style. And there's a lot of people who actually only like a certain form of Batman, which is the movie Batman, the either Nolan Batman, Burton Batman, a general
or the Frank Miller Batman.
Frank Miller Batman.
That's the big one. Everyone's like,
I believe you mean the goddamn Batman.
The goddamn Batman.
And I think, I like the kid enough, but I think that's kind of what turns him up on as well, is that he hates that, you know, like that tough as nails Batman who's like a owner who hates everybody else. But there is a middle ground to that, and I think that's why I've enjoyed it, is because the animated series had that middle ground where he's not this brooding owner, but he's also not this over-the-top campy hero. I think I ought to
wear a different color bat suit every night.
What was neat about the Morrison stuff, it actually made me seek out all the old stories, which is really what was, but it was really, it, like, I started hunting down all those, like, collections of, like, the Batman in the 40s, Batman in the 50s, I mean, I own a lot of that, especially I learned about the Batman as R&R. I got fascinated by it, because I'm fascinated by the weird shit anyway in comics, so go figure. Yes, makes sense, isn't it, doesn't it, that I'm interested in all the weird shit in comics, but I really like the stuff that made me go, this is so strange. This is awesome. Must read more of this. And Morrison taps in, but it's also not just bringing weird shit. No, he brings stuff that you would not think would really fit into, like, the Batman continuity, and he makes it make sense. I mean, like you said, Batmite. He made Batmite really cool, and he really made it work. But then, outside of, like, a ha-ha funny, no, he made it really work. I mean, anything you would think, huh, this cannot, holy crap, he made that work, and he made it awesome. I mean, go back to his JLA run when he freaking used Triumph. Triumph! Yes, kids. By the way, if you don't know who Triumph is, he was a character that came out of Christopher Priest's Justice League Task Force run. Also, he was used in a JLA during, he came back during Zero Hour. No one knew what to do with him. Priest kind of got rid of him himself, and then he came back again during Grant's run, and then he did the, and sort of also helped begin the JSA being kind of brought back into the DC universe in a way, too. I summed it up really quickly here, but I missed a few blanks. But
I mean, you mentioned in the JLA, and this is another thing I hear, kind of, is that he gives Batman the God complex, where, like, people criticize the fact that his Batman tends to be overpowered in the JLA books. At least that's what I see people complain about. So, I mean, what do you think about that?
It's a little overpowered, and he kind of goes a little bit overpowered with Batman. I mean, it's kind of weird about how his Batman does go into the holy crap mode at times, but it's like, okay, well, Batman is okay. I mean, but also at the same time, he actually kind of explores the Batman as being, he might not be super powered, but he's pretty damn lethal when he wants to be, and he can pretty much, it doesn't really bother me that much. I think it's much more stuff that bothers, is that there really, it only is so much that bothers me. I think what is the weird thing about JLA for me is sometimes, and I hate to say, I mean, I don't want to be really mean about his JLA, but probably the only thing that really hurts sometimes is the really oddball art of Howard Porter being just okay. But I mean, it's not bad at all, but it's also kind of quirky on occasions, but it never has really bothered me to the point of, well, I get readers, but it's like, no, it's like, but I can kind of go, yeah, but it kind of works for me in to a degree, but even I look at it, but it's also interesting to see that it's very interesting to see how they kind of play into all these little, I mean, Batman is very powerful, I mean, but everyone is pretty dang powerful in Grant Morrison's JLA universe. I mean, He freaking put the new gods in there. He put the new gods. He put all the new gods in there. He put freaking Orion, and we got Orion. And he made Orion really awesome. It's good reason. There's good reason why we got an Orion series with Walt Simonson writing and illustrating it. Thank you, Grant JLA. It's because we got that Orion series.
I was gonna say it's kind of interesting because I got into the Justice League. Well, I mean with the cartoon, but I started reading the comics with Morrison's run.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this stuff, like you know, like saying Superman Blue was cool and Orion and stuff. I was like, I didn't know they were uncool beforehand because this is like my first exposure to them, and I thought he handles pretty much all the characters he introduces well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some Justice League turnover that's just like random, like you'll have random characters pop in for like an arc or two and then disappear. But no rhyme or reason. But I assume that was part of the larger DC issue at the time.
Yeah.
Right.
And one of the things that I like, his handling of Wally and Kyle.
Mm-hmm.
I think Wally was the Flash at the time and Kyle was the Green Lantern.
Correct.
And like that they bonded over that fear of not being as good as the originals. Like, we inherited these mantles and what are we supposed to do with it? And it's you know, you made these characters that I don't know if Wally got as much of it, but I know Kyle. Like, people were like, oh, he's not as cool as Hal Jordan. Kyle's not as cool as Hal Jordan. His girlfriend got shoved in a refrigerator. Yeah. But, you know, he was committed to making all of these characters someone that you could potentially understand. He didn't crap out.
Mm-hmm. He had a period where Diana disappeared as Wonder Woman, and then Hippolyta took over. So he just had Hippolyta be part of the JLA as part of Diana being there. And they're like, okay.
And that was kind of weird reading it for the first time because like nobody on the team acknowledges the fact that it's a different Wonder Woman. They're just like, oh, hey, Hippolyta, what's up? It's the same thing with Superman because during the first couple of issues, he has like that mutt phase, and he has the red and blue phase, and then he's back to the classic phase. And nobody's mentioning anything. I'm like, do none of you notice what's going on with your guy over here?
And then you really think about the fact that he brought in Dream. He brought in Daniel in the run, and people go, wait, how? And because that was during the period where Karen Berger would not hardly let Vertigo characters out of Vertigo. So, but really, see, Grant was on such good terms with Karen Berger, and was really, and he said, hey, Karen, I want to use Daniel in my JLA, And anyone else, she probably said no, but since Grant Morrison is Grant Morrison and she's not going to really argue with Grant Morrison, she's like, yeah, you can use Daniel. And boom,
Morrison also, wasn't he the one who introduced Tomorrow Woman?
Yes.
Like she was originally built and she became so popular that they revived her and brought her back. And it was this character that he just introduced for two issues. It was like one or two issues.
Yep, where it was a two-issue arc with Professor Ivo and Professor T.O. Morrow.
And
yeah.
Tomorrow Woman got brought back during Kurt Busiek's Trinity run, Trinity weekly series. And, yeah, Morrison's legacy on JLA is one of those that it's still been very hard to top that JLA. I mean, it's really telling that JLA is still so revered to this day because it's really hard. I mean, it's also the time period it came out of because the JLA during that was Justice League America. Oh my God, that was a mess. Have you ever read those pre-Morrison JLA issues before he got on board?
No, because everyone I've talked to has reacted with, oh my God, have you read those issues before he got on board?
That was actually the thing that got me back into comics was Morrison's JLA.
Okay.
At that point, and then getting me back in the comics later was Morrison's X-Men. So you see a pattern here.
Yes, I actually makes sense, and it's true. I mean, Morrison's one of those people that you can go and go, yeah. I mean, Morrison is definitely that sort of person that you go look at his comic and go, holy crap, this is unlike a lot of things that I've read. I mean, and really it's like even his action comics, I mean, I do say his action comics is very interesting, but he's also kind of in the fact that he's kind of telling the early days of Superman before he becomes a Superman right now, and that's a whole other subject for another day, because I don't want to get into my thoughts on Superman hate, but it's like, God, I mean, it's just one of the things where I actually feel like by the time I was done with Ultimate, I went, man, I am now kind of cranking on X-Men a little bit, because it was not too long after I took another look at the Avengers vs. X-Men, the recent issue, and I went, man, what the hell happened?
I think, you know, he's been focused on his JLL run and his X-Men stuff, but he does tremendous stuff with team books, which isn't something a lot of people can play off well. Like you mentioned with the JLA stuff, with the reboot before this one. Part of it, that was kind of muddied by DC's handling of the whole situation, but it never really got off the ground, and then it's like they couldn't get permission, or they couldn't find a way to use Core 7. So for a time, you had Nightwing, you had, like, that Gorilla Man, you had a bunch of, like, B and C listers on the team.
He had to get all these random people, and he couldn't do anything. I mean, like, James Robinson had a time and a half with it. Dwayne McDuffie had a very publicized time and a half with his JLA run, Justice League America run. I mean, the only part, like, Grant Morrison, the reason why his run worked so well, because they were trying to give him a little crap, but he said, no, I want the Big Seven. I want the Big Seven. Okay, Grant. Okay, they weren't arguing much with him. I mean,
I think that's what people need to understand about the Justice League, because it's something that they still go through, is that people don't, I mean, it's nice to have other members on the team, but it's still DC's premier team book, so it should have DC's premier heroes, not some people you could put together because everybody else is busy doing other stuff in their books.
Exactly.
Morrison understood it, and Bruce Timm understood it.
You have the Big Seven, and, you know, if you want to have Matter Eater Lad, okay, have Matter Eater Lad, but Matter Eater Lad does not get to be one of your focal points.
Exactly.
Because he eats matter.
It's funny how, because if you want to go back a little bit, and I want to touch on this really quickly, is the fact that with his JLA, because back in the day when the Justice League International, back still initially just called Justice League, when Giffen Diamantis took over, they couldn't put Superman, they couldn't put Wonder Woman, they couldn't probably put anyone on the team, because they were all either in the midst of a reboot, editorial change, you name it, they had something going on, and the Justice League kind of was Blue Beetle, Booster Gold, Black Canary, and it's a very odd little team. But by God, Giffen Diamantis made that work, and they did something else entirely different with JLA. And Morrison kind of did the idea of, no, I want the Big Seven, and I'm getting the Big Seven. And it was one of those situations where they went, oh God, if we don't give Grant what he wants, we're kind of screwed, aren't we? Yeah, your premier super team is screwed if you don't. Because they weren't.
They did, and the fact that I assume the books weren't doing that.
No, they weren't.
Oh.
So, we've seen DC's willing to do whatever it takes to get sales.
And they hit big. By the time Grant was through at JLA, JLA was one of the top tier books at DC. I mean, it was one of the books that could slip into the top 10 easily, because people really, if that had JLA hit in the top 10 quick, because,
It was like the top selling DC book for 2 years, 2.5 years.
Yeah. And
that's why DC put up the fight to get him back for Marvel, and why DC basically bent over backwards to win him back when he was so unhappy working for Marvel and working on X-Men.
And
the announcement took place at a con.
And then
Marvel didn't,
like,
know yet.
Yeah, and Grant was like, I'm done. And that was when the stuff... and then pretty much that's when he got pretty much any project he ever wanted at DC. It's like, you want to do a Seven Soldier? Sure. You want to do Final?
Yeah.
Sure. You can do whatever.
Why don't we just put you in charge of, like, developing some of our properties? And why don't we just name you Big King Fuck of Shit Mountain or whatever?
And that's what they did.
King Shit of Fuck Mountain. Thank you, Nick.
He is the King Shit
of Fuck Mountain. One does not simply walk up Fuck Mountain.
Yeah, the Grant Morris, it's like, it's kind of funny because that's, and like, how do we keep our people from ever leaving again? Grant, you get this position, hey, Jeff Johns, you're never leaving here again because we gave you the entertainment position, so...
And then you boot, then you screwed up Green Lantern, so we might take that away from you.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you're pretty much... But that's what DC does. If they want to keep someone, don't put them in a position where they'll never want to leave.
Hey, Gail Simone, you want Batgirl? You got Batgirl.
That's how they work. They just put them on a book and go, or they put them in a position where they're never going to want to leave. But it's interesting. And since we're about the hour 9 mark, and I know Nick, you're pretty hungry at this point, and yet you haven't eaten dinner yet. So we'll kind of find a good wrap up point here. And I mean, out of any of the things you ever read of Grant Morrison, you can even go into really obscure stuff of Grant Morrison, go nuts. But what was probably one of your defining things of a Grant Morrison, anything that you've ever read of his? Ash, go first.
Oh, shit.
Can I go first since I have an answer?
Go for it.
You go first.
I would just say the fact that he was able to make Aquaman a badass.
Yeah.
In the pages of Justice League. Like, he's done a lot of stuff, but the fact that he made Aquaman a character that people respected and feared in that comic is a testament to his abilities to understand these characters and what makes them work.
With a hook hand. He made him a badass with a hook hand.
And did it all without the Jeff Johnsian. Isn't he cool, guys? Here's everybody talking about how cool he is. This means he's cool, right? This means you should like him. Everybody likes him.
The first bit, I make notice a lot. Because I actually, I started to like Aquaman more after the first few issues of him getting it out of his system about making a ha-ha Aquaman joke. I hated ha-ha Aquaman. Haha, Aquaman took me out of the book every single time. People disagreed with me, but you need you don't need haha Aquaman. Just tell a damn Aquaman. He's starting to become cool again. You don't need to make a point to make a joke about him. Stop it.
Or you could make him a joke character, not necessarily a joke character, but I have the Aquaman on Brave and the Bold.
Yeah,
he's my favorite Aquaman.
Hi, I'm King of Atlantis.
Speaking of which, did any of you guys check out that Star Wars panel that went up a few days ago? The voice actors one?
I've seen a third of it. I need to finish it.
You need to watch. He does the Aquaman voice at one point.
Oh,
they switch characters. Like, all the actors switch characters and switch voices throughout the whole thing. It's
It
starts off with Bubbles as Darth Vader.
Yeah. And Batman
oh my God.
The narrator. Kevin Conley as Batman.
Oh my God. That might actually top New York Comic Con when I got to hear Kevin Conroy say, "Damn that iPhone," in the Batman voice.
now what I'm watching after we're done recording this, so. Let's see. Ashley, do you have an answer? Yeah.
It's difficult, but I feel like one of the things that just blew my mind was the end of Final Crisis.
Oh, God.
Where it's like, I'm going to stand here and narrate everything that happens, and everything's just going to be better. And the fact that, like, Superman saved the world by wishing for a happy ending. And it wasn't cheesy. That's just how it happened. And so much of what Morrison has done has blown my mind. But, like, that and... When we were talking about it earlier, when Daniel shows up in JLA, they're like, yeah, by the way, that's Starro, it's dreaming, it's evil, go kill it.
Yeah. And that's also, there's a funny story about the Starro, because I didn't get on the initial ground floor of JLA. I actually discovered it just after I got back in the comics again with Busek's Avengers. So it was Busek's Avengers, and then wasn't much longer when I discovered it's JLA. And like, Busek and Morrison are sort of like my superhero tent poles. If you ever want an idea of where I stand, Busek and Morrison are like my tent poles of superhero. And
Busek always wins.
Exactly. But, you know, like, they're my standard bearers of really cool people doing superhero stuff. I mean, I could do an entire thing on Avengers Forever one day that would probably make you go, whoa. but it's like, I saw the fat issue of JLA. I ran into that. I was just reading that and I was going, what the hell? This is the coolest Stara? Whoa, what is he doing with? Wow. Oh, this is crazy. And this is before I knew a lot of the major Vertigo stuff when I was getting back into this. And I saw Dan, like, wow. And then I learned later, like, oh, wow, this is like momentous crap. Wow, this is awesome. And that's interesting to me. It's one of the things where you feel like with Morrison, he kind of turns superhero comics into abstract unit literature. It's like, it's not just a superhero comic. It's superhero literature. It's him really getting deep down into the stuff and really going here. This is what goes here. This is what goes there. I mean, he really makes you get into it and really makes you explore into it. Like, I probably would have not read some of those more oddball Batman stories if it wasn't for him and his Batman run. Like I said, I explored the further bits of Batman I never would have explored before if it wasn't for, because some people have made them go, huh? Me, I went, I'm fascinated by this. I want to read more. There's reasons why I own a good chunk of the oddball Superman stuff that's in my collection. It's because Grant Morrison kind of helped me, made me go, like, stuff I went, what sense is this making me? Okay, I want to see how this makes sense, or I want to see how, and it fascinated me. I mean, go for it, Ash. I mean,
have you read Super Gods yet?
I've not read the entire. I need to sit down and read that entire thing, because it's one of the things where I want to sit down and just literally have, like, no, like, nothing poking at me for the entire day, just sit down and read Super Gods, just so I can, because I have not read, because I've heard, like, all the excerpts from it, but I've not read the entire thing. It's like, I know I'm bad, but I've been wanting to sit down and read this. I really want to focus on it.
Well, it's just you talking about, like, reading the oddball Batman and Superman stories, and just the stuff that he has to say about, like, those as psychology and as metaphors and depictions of acid trips.
Mm-hmm.
And just you get a whole new appreciation. It's not just like, oh, these were goofy stories that were put out in goofy comics. It's he makes you consider it in a new light, whether you agree or disagree in the end. And that's one of the things that I admire about him, is he truly loves comics, and mm-hmm. he wants you to understand this love and see what he loves about this and see how he views these things. So even if you don't end up liking them, you're at least like, okay, I see why this guy is passionate about this.
That's what I like about the creators, that when I do find, I read a certain comic and you go, wow, they really do love comics. They're really into this. They're one of the, with a really one that brings something new and different and exciting into this. Like, Nicholas, I should have said defining, but what was probably one of your favorite moments of a Morrison comic you ever read?
This is really hard because there's so many.
You can go nuts.
Like, if we're considering just, I'm just going to go just superhero stuff. I'm not even going to bring in Invisibles or Sea Guy or V3 or Phenomorama or any of that stuff. Or even Flex Mentallo. Holy shit.
I just read that, by the way. Fantastic. I just read Flex Mentallo. Wah!
I'd say there's got to be, I can give you a top three.
Go for it.
That's probably be the easiest one. One is the Die Hard moment from the first JLA story arc, where they find the one guy tied up with a note on it that says, I know your secret.
Mm-hmm.
Basically letting them all know that, holy shit, Batman's not dead, A. B, he's out running around, and C, he knows who the hell we are, and he's going to take us all down. Mm-hmm. And then he does that.
Yes!
It's basically his ho ho ho, now I've got a machine gun.
Oh, yeah. Awesome scene.
That's amazing. That was what made me, like, that was the beginning of my love affair with Batman as it stands right now.
Makes sense.
In the same vein, from Batman RIP, which, as much as I, you know, don't really like Tony Daniel that much, I don't really like his art, and that's one thing that consistently brings Grant Morrison down, is he gets paired with, I think, some artists who just don't get him, yep. I guess, or aren't up to par. Mm-hmm. But then he will be with some, like, some people, like, just get him. Like, that's why he's worked with Frank Quitely so much, why he's worked with Cameron Stewart so much.
Mm-hmm.
And some artists just get Morrison. But Tony Daniel did knock it out of the park of Batman literally emerging from his own grave. And, like, yeah. just a full-page splash. Just like, bam, Batman.
Yeah.
And the aforementioned from the X-Men run, the one shot of Magneto holding the Zorn helmet and saying, what does he say? You ever feel like you, what does he say?
Oh,
I forget the line now. But it's just such a wham, like, bam, gotcha.
Yes, actually, X-Men emergency indeed, Charles. The dream is over.
There it is.
Yeah.
Oh. That's why I kept them all nearby.
And he's standing in front of the Magneto Was Right poster.
Exactly. And also it was Jimenez who was doing the artwork during that.
Yeah. And it was just such a great moment because it built on the whole run. And it's one of those things where if you read all the other issues, you see it's there the whole time.
Just yeah.
subtle, but it's there. And it's not just something he pulled out of his ass to shock people. But he'd set that up the entire time.
And I love how people complain, like, oh, he just, you know, da-da-da, that came out of nowhere. It's like, no. No, 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 no. He built that the whole time. And, oh, God. You were talking about the Invisibles as a whole separate podcast. Like, I could just go on and on and on about my love for his take on mutant culture and the mutant gang that he puts together. And the stylistic... Like, we're going to dress the way they thought mutant overlords would dress.
Yeah.
That's another example of Marvel taking an idea of his and ruining it, I guess, by the Quentin Quire character. Which I think at the end was that he evolves to the point that he transcends his whole, like, petty hatred and bigotry and everything, and then, you know, obviously becomes one, blah, blah. But then they have to bring him back, and he's in the Phoenix Force. Now he's alive again, and he's starting trouble again, guys.
He's now part of the whole Phoenix connection with the Avengers vs. X-Men right now.
See, I saw that he was coming back, and for a second I was like, wow, I liked him on Morrison's run. And I'm like, wait, that doesn't make any sense that he's back.
Don't read the Wolverine X-Men Alpha Omega thing that came out recently. I like Brian Wood. He's one of my favorite writers. I like a lot of his stuff, but I did not like Wolverine X-Men Alpha Omega because of the way they had basically Quentin Quire create a giant alternate universe for Wolverine and armor that exist in because he couldn't stand Wolverine, so he just put him in an alternate universe. And now Wolverine's running the Berserker Rage because Wolverine's separated from his body in an alternate universe. And the way it was handled is kind of like, okay, it doesn't really work. I mean, it's really weird how they kind of work, and I kind of went, yeah, like, I can't, like, sorry, Brian, can't really go much further than what I'm gone, but... It was funny because one of those popped up in my, because I was like done with the series and then my comic guy had basically cut back his order and there was like one copy left and one of my buddies in the store was like, oh, there's no copies on the shelf. And I was like, hey, just take mine. Like, you can just buy it. Like, and he was like, oh, thanks, Wes. Like, no problem. Like, I'm good anyway. Didn't say. I'm done with the series, but you can go finish it around me. I finished two issues ago. So it's like, yeah, it's like, I'm good. Have fun. So, I mean, and it's one of those things where I go, yeah, Marvel pretty much playing with Grant Morrison's characters has gone good or very bad. Very, very bad. So, I mean, anything else you guys want to kind of get into before we wrap this dog and pony show?
Well, we talked about favorite moments. I'd say, what are some of your respective favorite stories of Morrison's? Like that would not just say like the whole Batman run or the whole X, like specific story arcs within said things.
The whole Batman run.
The whole Batman. I'm cool with it. I mean,
I was gonna say, given Batman a son, Damian, because I think at the time Superman also got a son. Mon-El or whatever.
Yeah, and that went to fuck right,
didn't
it? And that was exactly the thing.
It's like, Chris in the book, yeah.
Yeah, I remember just thinking, like, they're giving Superman and Batman a son. Superman was getting it because of Superman Returns. And I'm like, this would never work out. Superman's son's not in the comics. Damian is a marquee character in the Batverse now. And he's an awesome character.
And that goes to show you how that works. It's like, Damian, marquee character. People manage to really like Damian. Superman's son, he's gone now. He kind of faded away.
He's on the moon with Steve.
He never existed. He never happened. It never happened now. That's a total casualty of the New 52. That's actually not a bad idea.
I think that just goes to show you what happens when you introduce a character to introduce it for editorial mandate, and when you introduce one with a fan, because he had a fan with Damian, and Damian has grown a lot since he's been introduced in the comics, and I think the part of it is because the Bat Family is such a great thing, because he has different dynamics with almost every member of that family. He acts different with Bruce, he acts different with Dick, he acts different with Tim.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever actually seen him interact with Jason.
Did they? They never have had him interact with Jason much, have they?
Good, fuck Jason Todd.
I think Damian would be like, yeah, this would be Damian and Jason Todd. I think he would actually say exactly what you said, Nicholas.
I think he would kill him.
And he'd be like,
yeah.
You're a little bitch, aren't you?
He would kill Jason Todd.
He'd say, you're a bitch.
Make some joke about a call or something, I don't know.
Nicholas, story.
It might not shock everyone, but I'm just going with superheroes because, you know, I would just say the Invisibles and go for 10 minutes. Fantastic Four 1, 2, 3, 4.
Really?
Because
it's a self-contained thing. That's why. And like all of Morrison's stuff is self-contained, but they all have to show the impact of the outside universe or like play off what's happened. Like we said with JLA with the Electric Superman, or even with his Batman run where he had to do the resurrection of Ra's al Ghul. That the reason 1, 2, 3, 4 is awesome is, you know, the whole Namor totally with fuck Sue. Reed Richards thing is awesome. It's a story about Dr. Doom thinking he is the badass motherfucker on the planet and just getting utterly schooled. And the fact that it ends with a giant robot.
God.
So, but in a really, what's considered to be a dark and serious, serious business story, superhero story at the same time, which shows that even in the dark and serious, serious business superhero stuff, Morrison does crazy shit that's awesome and fun.
Yeah.
It also doesn't hurt that I think that might have been the first Grant Morrison thing I wrote of his Marvel work. I didn't write it. Morrison wrote it.
Grant Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
I neither confirm nor deny that.
Good move.
Yeah.
I'm onto your games.
So that's where
Grant.
So now I know where you disappeared to one weekend when that whole Morrison Con was going on.
So nothing?
Morrison Con.
Yeah, I actually had a conversation with somebody on Twitter about us, we wish we could go to the Morrison Con because that would be the most fun weekend ever. And then one of those, holy crap, what would be going on at Morrison Con? I don't know, but I wish I could find out.
I saw someone refer to it as a carnival of ego, and I'm like, fuck yeah.
He's allowed. He's Grant Morrison. He's allowed to have a carnival of ego.
In fact, he will probably write a future storyline entitled Carnival of Ego.
Surprised he hasn't yet.
I'm genuinely surprised he hasn't.
Well, he will, now that he's heard about it, on this podcast.
Yes,
on which
will.
He is a guest, Nick Reed.
No, I'm Nicholas Reed, the writer of stupid articles about movies.
Speaking of odd writers, what is up with Justice League and that whole book thing they have going on? Or does somebody read that?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
There's like, the Justice League is like a book within a book now. Somebody's writing the story of the Justice League. It's like
the Grave story arc is going on right now. Oh, man alive. That's that's an interesting story arc. Because the first issue of that story arc just came out a couple weeks ago.
I think I read it, but I really don't care about the Justice League right now.
I actually have something I'm building in my head that I'm about ready. I'm this close. I'm pretty. That's been percolating in my head about why I've been getting burnt out on the new. I'm starting to get disconnected from a lot of the new 52 because it's kind of like right now, like Justice League. I'm going, well, this is cool. Yeah.
Hold on. Let's just wrap first and then we can talk because I'm not sure if my connection's going to add.
Yeah, let's. Okay. So, okay, because we got Nicholas' favorite story. Earl, what would be your favorite story of Grant's?
Oh, I thought I went with the Damian being introduced stuff.
You went Damian. Ashley, what's kind of like one of like your favorite? You can go one of favorites either.
One of my favorites is, since we were talking about X-Men mostly today, the Ride at Xavier storyline. Because as I said, I prefer stories that are rooted in the school. Because for me, the story of X-Men is largely the story of teenagers going through this very awkward phase in their life where they happen to start like blowing shit up with their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And just a lot of what he did with that. And when he, you know, setting Magneto up as this counterculture symbol, which of course later comes back and bites him in the ass when they tell him like, they don't want your leadership. They don't want your ideals. They want your picture on a t-shirt.
They want you dead.
Yeah. They want your face as something that they can rally their own movement behind. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, you know, Kid Omega calling out Professor Xavier when he says something about, you know, you talk about your ideals and you talk about us wanting to explore and decide for ourselves. What happens when one of us decides we don't agree with you?
Yeah.
Which is a good question. What happens when one of your students doesn't agree with what you have to say?
Yeah, I mean,
so that one is probably my favorite.
and I actually have to, I give that because that was the one that made me, and all that entire book when I was reading that, that was the arc that made me go, holy shit! Like, wow! That is crazy! But that worked so well. And actually, if I'm going to say a Morrison, I mean, I know we've been sticking strictly to mainly superhero, one of the things I do want to get into reading more of his Doom Patrol work, because I have not read all of that yet. I'm working through his Animal Man run. I actually have all three trades of his Animal Man run, and that's a story for another day when I finish that up. But I actually want to get non-superhero, because the one recent story, because I really blew my... I just finally read Flex Mentallo, and oh god, oh my god, Flex Mentallo! Wow, that book! Holy crap!
Yes.
Oh my god! Like, yes, the room that's okay.
See, basically, you read Final Crisis before it was Final Crisis.
Yes, and it was amazing. It was so
and crazier.
It was crazier than Final Crisis. So I wish I would have known that they actually did some subtle recoloring from the original version of it, because I was on Bleeding Cool and I read that, and I saw like how they did some very odd recoloring it of the series for the deluxe edition, that they took, instead of like the four color stuff, they kind of went with more realistic coloring in parts, and they kind of did some stuff like, it's not so bad, it's not a deal breaker, the coloring still looks nice. I mean, because it's almost a toss between Plex Mentallo and We Three. It's my favorite Grant Morrison stories. It's one of my favorite stories of his, because I've read We Three about three or four times. Oh god, have I read We Three more. With We Three, I've actually told people, I actually go, here, read We Three. Next day I go, one of my friends actually said, Wes, thank you for letting me read We Three. Like, thank you for telling me to read this, because I love this so much. I read it twice in one. I read it twice in one day. It's like, okay. I'm like, yep, that's We Three. Or Flex Mentallo, that's going to be another one of those books. When people read that, they'll go, oh my god, that was so cool. Can I read it again? And even probably one of my favorite JLA, and if we're going superhero, his favorite JLA story is, I love Earth 2. I love that book very, very much. Because the way that he handles that whole thing is so freaking cool. I mean, Frank Quitely drawing this, like, very, like, dark, twisted version of Earth 2 and how he handles everything in there. It's like, oh, that is so cool. Because I own the hardcover editions of the JLA that have all those stuff, and I own also still the graphic novel Earth 2 in my collection, so it's like, I have it twice over. I have Wii 3 twice over. It's like, I own some of this stuff twice over in either single issues or hardcovers, but I don't care because I really like their stuff that if I like it, I will own a big, shiny, collected version of it because I really liked it. And
oh, shit. Oh, fuck. You know what? I completely forgot something.
Go for it.
My favorite story is also Superman. I can't believe I forgot that.
So, yeah.
Totally.
Holy shit. The reason I got reminded is because I actually own that in three different versions. I own the issues, I own the two paperbacks, and I own the Absolute.
I own the Absolute, too. The big gargantuan freaking Absolute. I love that dang thing.
All-Star Superman. It's not my favorite. Like, I'm still going to go. But that just, like I said, I'm not a Superman fan. All-Star Superman, just, I sat there at the end going, holy fuck. This is the Superman story.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite reactions to it was apparently someone asked Grant Morrison, does this mean Superman is God? And Morrison replied, well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
That.
Yes.
And on this note, on the Superman is God note, we're...
always a good note to end on.
Always a good note to end on Superman is God. And also Batman is awesome. That's more Nicholas's note to end out on, but I will.
Batman always wins.
Thank you. But this was actually one of the episodes I kind of was doing it as an experiment to kind of see if like down the road if we can end up doing a full on Grant Morrison, like really explore like more of the Invisibles podcast, because we've talked about this for a while, and we've been talking about doing a full-on Invisibles cast for, good lord, since we all kind of started going, we need to do an Invisibles cast. So this is kind of a neat idea, and I think we realized, holy god, we all have a little bit of something to share on this, whether we realize it or not. And for any of you guys out there that have never really read any of this stuff, if you really want to get an idea, love it or hate it, Grant Morrison... The one thing about him is everyone should really at least read one Grant Morrison story. Two, you should really give yourself a shot to read it. Open mind, just come in, read it. And love it or hate it, you will be thinking. And that's a lot to say for a lot of authors that you will think a lot of them they don't, you kind of go, okay, that was fun. Like, no, you actually end up thinking after going, yeah, what was that meaning? Or how did that work out? And not a lot of people can say that. And that's something I can appreciate about Grant Morrison at the end of the day is anything he does, I will always have a deeper reaction. He'll be one of those people that I actually have a more deeper reaction to that, like, down the road than I would. Like sometimes I'll go fun, but more like I'll have a very deep reaction to thinking about it in a more in-depth way. And really... Do yourself a favor and go hunt. If you're interested, all the new X-Men stuff's in print. Everything we've mentioned is all in print. You can find it. You can pretty much find all this very easily. I mean,
like the Ultimate Invisibles collection, I think, is coming out this year.
August.
Oh, hell yeah, it is.
August, 1,000-plus pages. And also, the trades, they are still in print. You can still find those, too, if you...
I have all of them.
I have all...
I have all of them. I have the Disinformation Companion to the Invisibles. I have the book Patrick Meany wrote called Our Sentence is Up, which I would highly suggest anyone who's read the Invisibles check out.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
I have seen the Grant Morrison documentary. Yeah.
So on this is Nerds on the Rocks, episode number 97. And remember... It's all in between the panels, kid. Catch you later.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical. I should be allowed to glue my poster. I should be allowed to think. I should be allowed to glue my poster. I should be allowed to think. I should be allowed to think. I should be allowed to think. I'm not allowed to think.